ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 30th of April. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. The US Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth has testified before Congress for the first time since America and Israel launched a war against Iran. The fiery hearing has seen heated exchanges on the purpose and cost of America's war efforts. Our correspondent Rachel Clayton has been following the hearing and joined me a short time ago.
This is the first time the Defence Secretary, Pete Hegseth, has answered questions publicly from politicians about the war with Iran. Early on, the Pentagon's top finance official was asked about the cost so far, and he told the House the war has cost America $25 billion, so roughly $35 billion Australian so far. It's a figure that's well below estimates from experts that have spoken to media. They've put the estimate of the cost of the war at roughly $1 to $2 billion a day, and we're 60 days into this, so that would say at least $60 billion. So it's quite a small figure. The politicians really grilled both Pete Hegseth and this top finance official about that number, asking them if they could break down the $25 billion, what was spent on what. That didn't really happen. They said that they'd get back to the House representatives about that. Secretary Hegseth was also really grilled about the war, its purpose, its ongoing costs, the reason why nuclear weapons were still a threat by Iran after Operation Midnight Hammer, which was last year, the one that the president says obliterated Iran's nuclear capabilities. Mr. Hegseth dodged a lot of those questions. He continued to say, as we've heard him say before in press conferences, that Iran must not have a nuclear weapon and that they almost had one, and that's why this war was started. He was clearly not happy with almost every question he was asked by Democrats. This is what Democratic Representative Ro Khanna had to say when Mr. Hegseth continued to not answer a question posed by many Democrats about the ongoing costs the war would cost Americans.
You don't know what we paid in terms of the missiles that hit the Iranian school. You don't know what we're paying in terms of gas. You don't know what we're paying in terms of food. $25 billion number is totally off. It's the incompetence.
The secretary was also very defensive in a lot of the answers he did give. He threw questions back at politicians quite often, similar to the hearing we saw about a month ago with former Attorney General Pam Bondi. It got quite fiery. After being criticised by one particular Californian Democrat about embroiling the US in a, quote, quagmire, the secretary really lashed out.
Shame on you, calling this a quagmire 2 months in. The effort, what they've undertaken, what they've succeeded, the success on the battlefield that could create strategic opportunities, the courage of a president to confront a nuclear Iran, and you call it a quagmire?
The US Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth there, and before him, our correspondent Rachel Clayton in Washington. Lebanon's deputy prime minister says the ceasefire in his country is not holding because the Trump administration has effectively given Israel free rein to launch bombing raids whenever they deem it necessary. In an interview with the ABC, Tariq Mitri has criticised Israel for continuing attacks in the south of Lebanon, while also insisting the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah needs to take responsibility for the crisis facing the country. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports.
From northern Israel, the noise of explosions in southern Lebanon have rung out in recent days, along with the constant buzz of Israeli surveillance drones. The attacks by Israel on claimed Hezbollah targets and the retaliation by the militant group on Israel doing little to ease concerns that this is a truce in name only.
It's precarious in one way, and in another it's loud and clear that Israel doesn't think it should be bound to the ceasefire.
Tariq Mitri is Lebanon's deputy prime minister.
The ceasefire is not total, is not permanent. It's a partial ceasefire.
Dr. Mitri says that's because of the way it's been drafted. Donald Trump announced the ceasefire after talks between the Israeli and Lebanese ambassadors to the United States.
They were told that President Trump had asked the Israelis to abide by ceasefire, a desirable ceasefire. That's all Lebanon has been informed of. It's only later that we found out there was this text issued by the State Department.
That text was later published online, saying the ceasefire didn't stop Israel from taking all necessary measures in self-defense at any time against planned, imminent or ongoing attacks. This, Tarek Mitli says, is allowing Israel to continue launching strikes against claimed Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon.
The distinction between defensive military operations and offensive military operations in the case of Israel is never clear. It's blurred. The lines are blurred.
Well, it's a very unique ceasefire because Lebanon and Israel are not at war.
The U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio described his view of the situation in an interview with Fox News on Monday.
Israel's problem is with Hezbollah. Unfortunately, Hezbollah happens to be inside of Lebanon and conducting attacks against Israel.
The current conflict erupted when Hezbollah opened fire on Israel in early March, in solidarity with their Iranian backers, just days after the US and Israel began their war on the regime in Tehran. In the period since, Lebanese health authorities say more than 2,500 people have been killed in Israeli strikes, including hundreds of women and children, and the government says civilian infrastructure has been wrongfully targeted. Hezbollah has continued to launch rockets and drones at Israel in response. In recent days, the IDF says it's destroyed Hezbollah weapons stockpiles and tunnel networks, prompting this promise from the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu.
We are destroying their terrorist infrastructure. We are killing scores of terrorists, and we are not done yet.
Hezbollah insists it won't stop attacking Israel as long as Israel is launching strikes in Lebanon and occupying Lebanese territory. And it's criticised the Lebanese government for even entertaining talks with the Israeli government while Israel continues its bombardment. But Dr. Mitli says the group needs to take some responsibility for the situation.
Hezbollah is both an actor and a problem in a way. But I think the general perception in Lebanon and beyond Lebanon was that Hezbollah has dragged Lebanon into a war that the majority of the Lebanese didn't want.
This is Matthew Doran in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
Police in the UK have declared a terror incident after two Jewish men in North London were stabbed. It follows a series of anti-Semitic attacks, and the events have prompted Prime Minister Keir Starmer to promise better protection for Jewish communities. Elias Kluwer reports from Golders Green in northwest London.
It's broad daylight in North London. Two men are going about their day when they're attacked violently with a knife. Confronting CCTV vision appears to show an alleged perpetrator chasing one man and plunging a blade into his upper body several times. Local security then pounces on the suspect. When police arrive, they apprehend him using tasers. Authorities have since said the alleged attacker turned his knife on officers as he was being arrested. The two men who were attacked are Jewish. The scene of the incident, Golders Green, is a renowned Jewish community in London. The alleged perpetrator is a 45-year-old man who police say has a history of violence. Authorities have since declared the attack a terror incident. He's the head of London's Metropolitan Police, Mark Rowley.
It's another horrendous act of violence directed against our Jewish communities. It will rightly shock and anger people across London and in the immediate communities and across the country.
On the streets of Golders Green, there is a palpable anger.
I'm not British, right? I grew up in Germany, of all places, as a Jew, which is an interesting story in its own right. I came here for a better Jewish life, and this is not what I came for.
We're not surprised, but we're shocked. So we were waiting for this to happen. This doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Counter-terrorism police are investigating at least six other arson attacks on synagogues since the US-Israeli strikes on Iran. And in October last year, two worshippers were killed after a man rammed a car into a synagogue on the Jewish holiday Yom Kippur. Kami Badenoch, the leader of the Conservatives, which is in opposition, said the spate of anti-Semitic violence should constitute a national emergency.
I'm absolutely horrified. This is something which we have known has been escalating in terms of terrorist attacks and anti-Semitic incidents. Just speaking to the community this morning, it's very scary for them. They're absolutely terrified.
The Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, has acknowledged that this is not an isolated incident and has pledged to provide better protection in Jewish communities.
What an appalling attack this is. And my thoughts and all of our thoughts are with the victims, their families and their loved ones. And been a series of anti-Semitic attacks. And I know firsthand the anxiety that that is causing in the community.
The two men who were attacked are in a stable condition in hospital. This is Elias Cluett in London, reporting for AM.
Yesterday's inflation figures confirmed what many households already know, that costs are continuing to rise. High fuel prices are the main driver of inflation, but housing costs are a significant contributor too. A new analysis has found that there are barely any rentals deemed affordable for people on the lowest incomes. Isabel Masali prepared this report.
If you just look up in here, dry mould.
Brett Henderson, colleague, and his mum don't want to be living in this ageing Perth apartment, but they can't afford a different rental. It's $510 a week for this uni student on youth allowance payments and his mum, who lives off her Canadian pension.
We are going into debt because the income that we do have coming in only can pay the rent. It doesn't cover utilities. It doesn't cover food.
Anglicare Australia often sees situations like this. For the last 17 years, it's been assessing the nation's rental affordability for those on the lowest incomes. Casey Chambers is the executive director.
The message is that there really is nowhere that is affordable.
This year, researchers examined nearly 49,000 rental listings from one weekend in March. They deem a place affordable if a household spends no more than 30% of its budget on rent.
So if you were a single young person on youth allowance, there was not one single room or house or unit that would have been affordable for you. If you were on Job Seeker as a single person, there was one.
The support service is renewing calls to boost the supply of social and affordable housing and wind back unfair tax breaks.
We've been talking about capital gains tax and negative gearing for about a decade. I feel like I'm a broken record, but we're ecstatic this year to know that, you know, that there are these conversations are going on within government.
In a statement, a spokesperson for Housing Minister Claire O'Neill said the government has increased rent assist by more than 50%, brought in better tenancy protections with state partners, and is building 55,000 social and affordable homes. They didn't comment on budget measures. Professor Stephen Rowley hopes next month's budget will deliver changes to capital gains tax and negative gearing. He's from the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute's Curtin Research Centre.
Overwhelmingly, these benefits go towards wealthier households and don't feed down into the provision of housing for low-income households.
He adds those Australians are in a very difficult position right now with the cost of living. Australian Bureau of Statistics data shows a rise in inflation to 4.6% in the year to March. That's the worst figure since September 2023. Rising fuel costs are a major factor.
This time it's very much the supply side which is pushing up costs, and there's really a limit to what can be done about that, particularly given a lot of the cost increases are coming from factors that are outside Australia.
Professor Rowley is among several experts expecting an interest rate rise next week.
Isabel Masali reporting there with Case and Ho. New research has revealed the scale of gambling amongst construction workers is well above the national average. The study found almost 90% of workers surveyed had gambled in the past year, with 2 out of 5 considered high risk. National Work reporter Bronwyn Herbert has more.
Jay Bedjick carries the scar on his arm from a grinder accident at work. The plasterer from Sydney's southwest says the injury happened when his mind wasn't on the job, but instead on his next bet.
If there was a way to bet, it was happening, you know. Sports bet was a major one. In the morning, early in the morning when the soccer games are on, for example, and then getting off to work and then checking the phone throughout the day, keeping updated with the scores. And then during the middle of the day, there'd be basketball or NFL.
Looking back, he says the danger wasn't just the money he was losing, but also his lack of focus in a high-risk job.
Gambling is just as common on a job site as another hard hat. Whether I was working in a scissor lift high up or working with heavy machinery, your mind not being there, it's like working in a cloud.
New research suggests his experience is far from unique.
So 89% of the participants in our study of construction workers have taken part in at least one gambling activity over the past 12 months.
Anna Dineshkina from the Insights Centre led the research. It's the most in-depth study to be undertaken in Australia on gambling behaviour among construction workers.
These are really high numbers. They are well above sort of national general population averages.
Online gambling is now more popular than poker machines, making the problem easier to hide and harder to detect.
And that just shows us that the digital age has really impacted the way that someone gambles, and it impacts the way that someone hides their gambling as well.
Alex Kaliris is the programs and clinical manager at Foundation House, a not-for-profit rehabilitation centre treating drug, alcohol and now gambling addictions. More than half his clients are classed as pathological gamblers.
So what defines pathological gambling is that it affects you and your family. You are spending all the money and your partner doesn't have enough money to buy groceries, can't afford the mortgage anymore.
David Atkin from the Construction Industry Drug and Alcohol Foundation says mobile betting introduces a new and serious safety risk.
Previously, you would go see someone reading the form guide in the can in the lunchroom or going to the pub. But now they can be on site and they can be betting and being in a high-risk position.
Advocates are calling for more on-site training to recognise signs of problem gambling. Jay Bedjick's gambling spiral ended 5 years ago when a co-worker intervened and took him to rehab. He says speaking up saved his life.
It's important for people to know that they are safe to come to talk to people because life is too precious.
Plasterer Jay Bedjick ending that report from Bronwyn Herbert. And if you or anyone you know needs help, you can contact Gambling Help Online. You can reach them on 1800 858 858. Advances in technology mean we have touchscreens on all sorts of appliances and white goods, but sometimes that makes life harder rather than easier, especially for people who are blind or have low vision. More from National Disability Affairs reporter Naz Campanella.
For Melbourne woman Phoebe Jane, enjoying a morning coffee isn't as simple as it is for many other Australians. The 49-year-old is vision impaired. Her machine only has one button she can feel, so family members have taught her how to make one type of coffee.
It is really frustrating. I just don't feel as independent, which is probably the worst part.
If someone accidentally changes the settings, she's stuck without her caffeine fix because she can't feel or see the screen and buttons to navigate the machine. It's the same for her dishwasher, washing machine, and oven. In recent time, many appliance manufacturers have done away with raised buttons, instead replacing them with touch screens.
I had an electric stove once, and I did accidentally turn that on. I could have burnt myself really badly.
Phoebe Jane isn't alone. A survey done by disability services provider Vision Australia has looked at the experiences of more than 700 people who are blind or have low vision when using appliances. It found more than one in two felt advances in home technology had made their life more difficult. 60% said they'd had to modify appliances or seek help to use them. And 4 out of 5 people who had no vision at all reported avoiding them completely. Chris Edwards is from Vision Australia.
Just relying on touchscreen without any other solution makes these products completely inaccessible.
Some companies have started designing apps available on mobile phones. And if someone with vision impairment uses voice technology on their phone,
how do I set my dishwasher to eco-energy saving mode?
Then they'll be able to use that technology to operate the home appliance. But there are pitfalls with that too.
How do I set my dishwasher to express?
You need to have access to the internet, hope the technology works properly, and have the skills to use it. Chris Edwards says there are strict safety standards for appliances, and he now wants the same for accessibility.
We should not be in 2026 advocating for people to do basic functions within their home.
He says an ageing population means the market for accessible products is growing, and that more accessible technology means less pressure on programs like the National Disability Insurance Scheme.
If manufacturers develop accessible products from the start, that would eliminate the need for additional programs to support functions for people of blind and low vision.
As Phoebe Jane sips her much-needed cuppa, she says she wants manufacturers to start employing people with disability to road test products before they hit the market.
There has to be solutions, you know, just for some very simple things to be put in place that would help everybody.
Melbourne woman Phoebe Jane ending that report from Naz Campanella. And that's AM for today. Thank you for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast.
The NDIS is about to be slashed, but what tool will the government use to determine who gets to stay and who doesn't? Today we speak to Martin Laverty, an architect of the scheme, on what to expect. Look for the ABC News daily podcast on ABC Listen.